Hello out there on the internet. I am Matthew Galt, and this is Cyber. Today's episode is an action-packed double feature that feels like it's been pulled directly from a cyberpunk novel. That's right, today's episode is all about railway strikes and killer robots. It's hard to be a railway worker in America. The schedules are a nightmare. They're the kind of working conditions that can make someone real sick. Just don't try to use your sick days. So facing a railway strike, Congress passed legislation to prevent it, all at the behest of the White House. And we'll get into that, and then we'll also talk about San Francisco. The city by the bay has written rules for killer robots. SF won't have the first police department in America that's killed someone with a killer robot. It'll just be the first with rules. With me today to talk about all of this is Motherboard senior writer Aaron Gordon. He's been following both stories. The railway strike for more than a year. You may remember he was on the show in April, I believe, talking about the horrifying conditions of America's rail workers. And, well, here we are. Aaron, thank you so much for coming on to Motherboard, or coming on to Cyber and walking us through this. You're always on Motherboard.
It's a pleasure, as always.
All right, so let's start with this railway... I don't know why I can't say that. Let's start with this railway strike. What's going on? We're talking on Friday, December 2nd. A whole bunch of stuff happened this week. Can you kind of run us down what's going on?
Yeah, if you think talking about this is hard, just wait till we get to precision scheduled railroading, which is a very hard thing to say three times fast. So what happened this week was, well, actually, we should go back to mid-November when the two largest... There are 12 rail unions involved in this negotiation with five of the largest freight rail companies in the country. And so obviously this is a very complex negotiation. And so once the tentative agreement in September, the Biden administration helped broker a tentative agreement between the railroad companies and the 12 unions. And the tentative agreement was then voted on by all the 12 unions, the members of the 12 unions. And in mid-November, the two largest and most influential freight rail unions tallied their votes. And basically, it was a very narrow result in both directions. One union narrowly agreed to the contract by, I think, about 54% of the vote. And the other union, which goes by the abbreviation of SMART-TD, they actually have like two sub-votes within their union. Absolutely everything about this is more complicated than you think it's going to be. And within those two sub-unions, they split their vote. One narrowly approved the contract, the agreement, and the other narrowly voted it down. So the short version is about like four unions rejected this tentative agreement. And what that opened the door for was a nationwide rail strike. Because if only one union votes against the contract, there's basically like an agreement amongst all the other unions to respect the picket line, to show solidarity. Once the four unions voted against the contract, basically that kicked the ball back to Congress, because under this law that was passed in 1926, Congress has the ability to basically impose whatever contract terms it wants on the railroad industry, because it's considered a matter of national interest to have the railroads keep running. And so what happened earlier this week is President Biden, before Congress actually did anything at all, President Biden came out with a statement, I think it was late on Monday night, basically asking Congress to impose the terms of the tentative agreement on the union, on the freight rail unions. So again, to recap, this was Biden, who considers himself the most pro-labor president in history, telling four unions that voted against a tentative agreement that he actually wanted to force them to abide by that agreement. And Congress...
What's his justification?
His justification is that it would be so detrimental to the national economy to have a freight rail labor strike, and that the terms of the tentative agreement are fundamentally good for workers, in his mind, that it's in the national interest to force this agreement on the workers to prevent a rail strike. And Congress dutifully went about its business and did this. The House passed the legislation, I think it was on Wednesday, and the Senate passed it yesterday. A little coda to this is House progressives also included an amendment that would include an additional 7 paid sick days in the tentative agreement, which is above and beyond what the agreement already has. That narrowly passed the House basically along party lines, and it got 50, I believe it was 53 votes in the Senate, but it needed 60 to pass. So it did not get included in the final agreement. And that's where things are. Biden said he's going to sign it as soon as it gets to his desk, and then it's over.
Now, I know you've been talking to a lot of railway workers. What's their reaction? How are they feeling right now?
So I've talked to hundreds of railroad workers over the past 18 months for various stories I've been doing on this general subject. And absolutely everything that has happened so far is basically exactly what they expected from the very beginning. Absolutely none of this has been a surprise, but that doesn't mean they're not feeling defeated and disappointed by the whole thing. The general vibe was this was how it was going to go. And once it happened, a lot of people are going to quit because they viewed this as their kind of like last chance to win a better life on the railroad. They view this as kind of the last sign that all the power, that they don't have any friends in the halls of power, that they have no way to fight for the kinds of things they want to improve their lives. And so the vibe I get, and this is something that other reporters have reported on too, and, you know, doesn't really seem to be a controversial take, is that, like, we're going to get basically a slow motion railroad strike over the course of several years just by the depletion of the workforce through attrition. And they're not going to be able to hire people back fast enough as they leave because the conditions on the railroad are so bad. And so by averting a short-term railroad strike, we're inviting a much longer, much slower bleed that's going to result in a very similar kind of disruption to our way of life.
What were the conditions of these contracts? What was so bad about them?
So the contract itself has a 24%, a maximum of 24% pay increase, which sounds like a lot, but keep in mind that the negotiations over this contract have been going on for more than 2 years now. Nobody's gotten a raise during those 2 years, and inflation has been very high. And the 24% raise is prorated over the next couple of years. So it essentially is a 24% raise over 5 years, which, given the rate of inflation, is not terribly significant. It's obviously like better than nothing, but it's not as much as it sounds like when you just say 24%. It's not like starting on January 1st, workers get a 24% raise. They have there are some very modest improvements to their healthcare, which is generally quite good. But the biggest thing is that workers pay was never the problem. Healthcare was never the problem. The problem that workers are so upset about is the railroad industry has been slashing costs left and right, absolutely decimating their own workforce to try and save a buck over the last several years. And to simply make it so they can keep running trains, they've instituted incredibly draconian attendance policies that have workers basically not living a life outside of the railroad. Their work-life balance is just absolutely non-existent. And workers are getting sick, they're getting burned out, they're just terribly stressed all the time. It's just a frankly terrible way to live. And they were trying to get some semblance of work-life balance reinstated through this contract. And the way this has generally been simplified, and I would argue oversimplified in the national media coverage, has been to characterize this as an issue of sick days. And while that's certainly true that workers want more paid sick days that they can actually take to see their doctors, it's an oversimplification of what the issue actually is, which is that workers are trying to essentially force railroad companies to adequately staff their own trains and railroads so that they can run the service that they promise to shippers and to the American public.
Let's hover around the sick days thing, and I want to talk about it because it is kind of every headline. You know, it is kind of the way that it's being framed. I'm curious about why specifically. How many sick days do they get now? How many are they going to get in the new contract? And more importantly, can they use their sick days?
Yeah, so like, first of all, I just want to say that I'm sympathetic to kind of the way it's been covered as a sick day issue, because actually getting into what the problem really is like, is complicated and hard and difficult. It doesn't like easily summarize into a headline. So I am sympathetic to that, like, kind of shorthand version. But the kind of like short answer to all of your questions is they don't really get sick days. They have a certain number of days off that they can technically access. But the problem is there's no reliable guarantee that they will actually be able to take those days off. And to explain why, I have to get a little bit into how freight railroads actually work. So you think of trains and you think of schedules, right? Like most people, we live in the US, so maybe you haven't taken a train in a long time, but like, in most countries where people take trains regularly, they're used to running on schedules. You know, the train is supposed to leave at a certain time. And so the workers who work on those trains also work according to schedules that are highly predictable, and they can, you know, work in advance. That is not how freight railroad in America works. The way freight railroad in America works is the companies wait until the trains have enough goods attached to the locomotives that it's profitable enough to run that train. Now, that could be a mere matter of hours after the locomotive gets back into the rail yard. It could be a matter of days. It could be a matter of weeks. It could be that a locomotive literally just sits there waiting for more goods to come. What this means is that for workers, their schedules are highly, highly unpredictable. And what the new attendance policies until this year, the schedules that workers broadly had, and again, there are lots of exceptions here, but broadly, the people who actually worked on the trains had like a roughly 75% on, 25% off schedule. And when I say 75% on, I mean they're either on a train, they're in some other city that the train has gone to, sitting in a hotel waiting for a train to come back. Or they're sitting at home waiting for a call saying, be at the rail yard in, you know, less than 90 minutes, the train is ready to go. That's 75% of their time. And 25% of their time is theirs. They're not on call. They can't be called to come work on a train. It's theirs. Broadly, 5 weekdays a month, two weekend days a month. So 7 days off a month total was how it used to be. It was a tough life, but it was one that they made work, generally speaking. This year, the railroads have kind of across the board instituted much, much stricter attendance policies. Instead of 75%, they're now on call 90% of the time or more. And the way the attendance policy works is it's a point-based system, and you can only get more points if you are on call for 14 consecutive days. And you lose points if you miss a call, if you take a day off for any reason, pretty much, except for like your pre-scheduled sick days or, you know, like the number of days the railroad gives you off a year. If you take those, you don't lose points, but you also reset the 14-day clock. So basically, the long and short of it is it's extremely difficult to get more points and extremely easy to lose points. And if you lose you start with like an allotment of 30 points. And if you lose those 30 points, which by the way, you could lose from taking just 2 days off, then you get reset to 30 points. and you have like an investigate, you know, like a disciplinary investigation instigated. And then if you lose those second 30 points, you get 15 final points. And if you lose those points, you're fired.
So what happens if, you know, I'm halfway through my 14 days and I get the flu? Like, legitimately, I have the flu. I have to go to urgent care. They give me the flu. They give me the test to see if I've picked it up. And, you know, it pops positive.
So in that case, you can try and take a sick day, but your boss can also just tell you no and call you in if you're called into work. You can also just try and ride your luck and hope you don't get called to a train until you get better. If you get called for work and you don't show up, you could just take the point hit, but you'll lose. I'm trying to remember exactly how many points it is. It's like somewhere between 10 and 15 for every day you don't show up.
So you don't actually have sick days.
That's right. The sick days are largely like you could take them in theory, but in practice, it's very difficult to actually use them. And so all this conversation about like, this is about getting paid sick leave. The railroad workers I've talked to have been very skeptical from the jump that even if they won a contract that awarded them 7 more paid sick days or whatever, they don't have any guarantees they'd actually be able to use them. So they were looking for not only more allotment of sick days, but also a mechanism by which the railroad could not deny them. And that was essentially a hard line in the sand that the railroad companies were not willing to cross. And ultimately, the Biden administration and Congress sided with them. I mean, they didn't impose any terms on the contract that would have done that. So ultimately, the railroads got what they wanted.
All right, cyber listeners, we're going to pause there for a break. We'll be right back after this.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
All right, cyber listeners, thank you for sticking with us. We are back on with Aaron Gordon. We are talking about the railroad strike. I think I've decided to say railroad instead of railway. For some reason, that W trips me up. We're going to talk about killer robots in a second, but I do have a few more questions. I have a complicated one. Let me see if I can ask it the right way. So I'm thinking about like the political calculus of somebody like Joe Biden looking at the railroad workers' plight. So at the beginning of the conversation, we talked about how narrow the margins of the victory were for the people that rejected the contract and wanted to strike, right? If you're somebody like Biden on the outside looking in at this, it sure seems like the railroad workers are conflicted, and maybe this is a time when you can put the thumb on the scale. But it's more complicated than that, right?
It's more complicated than that for like many different reasons. The first complication I'm going to throw in there is we should not interpret the votes on the contract as a vote for a strike. And I'll tell you why. Because before the vote for the ratification comes up, like during the negotiation process, the unions held strike authorization votes. And these passed by like 99%+. Railroad workers are pissed off and they want to strike. I should rephrase that. They don't want to strike because they don't want to like destroy the U.S. economy, but they want to exercise their collective power to try and influence their working conditions for the better. When it came time to vote for the tentative agreement, right? At that point, they knew what the deal on the table was. They knew it wasn't going to address their concerns. They knew that if they voted against it, the overwhelming likelihood was Congress was just going to force it down their throats anyways, or maybe even a slightly worse contract, which was what the Presidential Emergency Board recommended back in August. The tentative agreement was like a very slight improvement on it. I think it had like one extra sick day allotment or something. So when a lot of workers went to vote on the contract, what I was hearing from a lot of workers was that there was a ton of apathy and just general kind of complacency with the whole process. Like, people didn't really know how to, like, whether to vote for or against the contract, because it was hard to weigh what a vote actually meant in the long run. If it came time to asking workers, like, are you mad about your working conditions for these very specific reasons? Would you like to take collective action against the railroads to exercise that discontent or show that discontent and exercise your power? Then the vote was just like incredibly overwhelmingly, yes, we want to do this. So that's the first complication I'll throw in. The second is from Biden's kind of like political calculus perspective. Look, I think there's a pretty broad consensus among the left progressive spectrum right now that he done fucked up royal, to put it in a technical term. Like, it is really, and I'll tell you why. It's really bizarre to me that he came out with a statement urging the tentative agreement to be forced upon workers before Congress even did anything. It put his foot in the ground on a position that is completely anathema to the kind of way he generally talks about himself as extremely pro-labor. And I don't think he had to do it, because by all indications, Congress was going to pass this anyways. And they passed it with a veto-proof majority, I believe, in both chambers. So why did he feel the need to put himself out there as being for this contract that the workers rejected, when he could have been like, I'm against this contract as written, give these guys more sick days, you know, get me those 7 sick days so we can at least say we did something for them, and then I'll sign that or something to that extent. There are just so many ways he could have played this to appear more pro-labor than he did. Like, the statement he put out was literally said, I'm pro-labor, but. And it's like, you know, it just, I think he really miscalculated this on a huge scale. And like, unions across the board are noticing what he's doing. And they saw what he did in a very public way, and I think are very confused about why he did it and what it means for the administration's support of the burgeoning labor movement in general. I mean, what does it say about a president who is only pro-labor when it's easy to be pro-labor? Does that really make you pro-labor? I think that there are really good questions to ask about his commitment to the labor movement as a result of this. I don't know if that answers your question. Please let me know if you
know
something else there.
It does. I just keep thinking of the cynical headline I would see if he had gone with the pro-labor route, right? Sleepy Joe cancels Christmas. Something of this nature, right?
I mean, look, it would have been, first of all, I don't think he had to go full let the workers strike. You know, you could just go, like, he could have just gone with, we've heard it loud and clear from the workers by rejecting this tentative agreement. It does not give the workers what they were looking for. So and it's been also clear from the 3 years of negotiation that the railroads are not willing to meet them in the middle on their very legitimate concerns. So we as Congress need to step in and give them another 7 days of sick leave, you know, or something like that. That's like kind of a middle road solution he could have done, where he's saying, I'm not advocating for us to allow a strike, but we do need to help the workers out a little bit. That's the whole reason we have this Railway Labor Act from 1926, because before that, railroads felt like they could just do whatever the fuck they wanted and impose whatever kind of horrendous working conditions they wanted on railroad workers. And they did. And it led to thousands of railroad workers dying while building and running the nation's economy. And, you know, he could have done something like that, but he didn't. And I think that's something that everybody's noticing.
So give me the apocalyptic scenario here. What are the consequences of this going to be?
Well, I first started writing about railroad issues in 2021 when I came across a YouTube video that a kind of like mid-level union rep recorded. And at the time I watched it, it had 6 views. But he was basically warning the American public that everything he was seeing on the roads was geared towards inviting a catastrophe. And by catastrophe, I mean turning a freight train carrying fuel, toxic, you know, freight trains carry hazardous materials. They carry petroleum, they carry fertilizer, they carry chemicals that we use for all kinds of industrial processes, because it's generally considered and is much safer than moving these things by truck. It's also cheaper, but for the purpose of this conversation, it's safer. What he was warning the American public about was that he was seeing such poor maintenance practices, such dire cuts across all lines of railroad operations, including maintenance, including procuring new material that ensures things run functionally, including making sure workers are awake and alert for when they're actually conducting these trains. And he was worried that there's going to be a circumstance where one of these trains is running through or by a major population center, something goes wrong, and it turns into a giant bomb and it explodes. Or it turns into a giant dirty bomb and it releases toxic chemicals into the air. This is not some, this, these are things that have happened before. A very famous case was in 2013, I believe, in Canada, just over the border, where a conductor basically lost control of a train because the railroad that owned the tracks had basically stopped doing maintenance on the tracks and the trains, and the brakes didn't work. And the train basically rolled down a hill into a town center. The train was loaded with petroleum. It rolled down a hill into the town center in the middle of the town, derailed, exploded. And I think like 120 people died, 80 people died, something like that. Like the town literally exploded. It was a massive catastrophe. And he was worried that this would happen again. And I reported that story out, and he was hardly the only one. This is a widespread fear across the industry. And I don't think it's something that is totally unfounded. I don't think they're doing it as like some kind of negotiating tactic to get a few extra percentage points on their salaries, right? Too many of the people I talk to don't even work in the industry anymore and have no real incentive to like be saying this anymore. They're worried. They're concerned. That's one thing that we should be worried about, is just our general health and safety. The other thing we should be worried about is we've spent the last 2 years talking about supply chains, right? Like Americans probably have more interest in the ins and outs of how the supply chain works now than ever before. And it turns out that a major bottleneck in our supply chains are the freight railroads. Over the last 5 years, freight railroads have slashed their workforce by 30% to try and increase their profit margins so they could pay off their Wall Street investors with increased dividends. BNSF, which has the most egregious attendance policy of all the major railroads and some of the biggest operational issues, had reported a $6 billion profit in 2021. So they're making a very clear choice about where their priorities are. And what we should be worried about is that the Biden administration has basically affirmed their approach, has basically told them through its own actions that it is not going to step in or interfere with their general management philosophy. And so they're going to continue to cut, workers are going to continue to leave, and the American railroads are going to continue to be a tremendous supply chain bottleneck. And that's a huge driver of inflation because the railroads have essential monopolies on their routes. They can charge basically whatever they want, run their railroads however they want. And by and large, their customers don't have a lot of choice. You know, if you're a fertilizer shipper, you basically can't ship your fertilizer by truck. Like, I mean, practically speaking, not only is it more dangerous, but it's also so much more expensive.
It's a bomb on the highway.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Like, there's way more accidents on the highway than there are on rail still.
Yeah. And I mean, like, look, and not only that, even if you think these people don't care about safety, like, there are federal regulations around this stuff. And also, like, even with the railroads charging so much more, the difference between the cost drivers of shipping something heavy and dense via truck and highway are just completely different. So that being said, you know, freight rail companies decide they want to start charging more for this stuff, and they can, and they have to, quote, accommodate for increased labor costs, which I think is just a lie. But, you know, that's my personal opinion. That's a huge driver of inflation, because that fertilizer goes to grow more food. And now the farmers say, well, you know, we got to deal with all these rising shipping costs. And so that leads to higher grocery bills. Those are just two examples of how this is going to continue to get worse if we countenance this kind of management philosophy that basically funnels money from railroad industry profits to Wall Street investors rather than reinvesting that money into its own business through hiring more workers and, reinvesting in its infrastructure. It's also the kind of thing that could just kind of metastasize and plug along, not in a way that is catastrophic to American society, but just in a way that makes everything a little bit worse. You know, makes everything a little bit more expensive, makes everything a little bit slower, makes workers a little bit more miserable, makes the labor movement a little bit less effective.
So business as usual in America.
Exactly. I think one of the, you know, I wrote an article that published this morning about 500 labor historians in the U.S. who signed a letter basically telling Biden he fucked up. Like, they're like basically saying, I mean, like, that's me paraphrasing it, but they were basically like, this was a moment for Biden to actually prove he is pro-labor by making a big call in a pro-labor way, in a very public national headline way that people would notice. And what we've seen time and again in U.S. history is transportation labor negotiations, especially railroad labor negotiations, ripple throughout the economy and ripple throughout the labor movement. When the government steps in to put down a railroad strike, the rest of the union landscape notices, the rest of the business landscape notices, and they notice the priorities that the government has set. Likewise, when the government steps in to support workers in railroad labor strikes, which happens a lot less often, but has happened in the U.S. history, most notably when Woodrow Wilson basically gave the workers what they want to prevent a railroad strike during World War I, again, the labor movement notices, and there was a huge boom in the U.S. labor movement after that. And so what Biden has done with this, I think probably the most realistic and detrimental consequence, is he has sent a very clear signal to the rest of the burgeoning U.S. labor movement. This is a tremendous time in U.S. labor and union enthusiasm, that actually the government doesn't have their backs, and actually the Biden administration is not as pro-labor as it says. And I think that's going to, in ways both obvious and not obvious, hurt the U.S. labor movement in a way that he really didn't have to.
So let's talk about something more cheery. You want to talk about killer robots?
Yeah, let's talk about killer robots. I don't have a killer robot here, unfortunately, but
you've got a bat. You've got a baseball bat there in the background.
That's my defense against killer robots.
I don't think that's going to help you against killer robots, Aaron. I'm sorry.
Well, you don't think it'll help when a robot slowly approaches me from 100 yards away holding a bomb?
Well, you know, if you're in a garage and you've never seen a killer robot before, armed only with an assault rifle, we're getting ahead of ourselves. We're getting ahead of ourselves.
We got to think about these things, man. They're here, all right?
you make fun, but we do have to. But let's let's talk about the city that is actually thinking about this and writing some of the laws down. What's going on in San Francisco?
Yeah, so San Francisco just passed an ordinance or a new city rule that says that basically allows the San Francisco Police Department to kill people with robots. It's just that simple. Like, that's what it says. It allows it. And the kind of more technical language is that it expands the city's use of force rules from human police officers to robot police, you know, robots deputized by the police department. I'm being facetious here. Like, you know, robots that the police department owns.
To be clear, not autonomous, something being steered by a human right now.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So something that, like, a human is going to be the person that chooses to push the button that kills someone. They are doing it through a robot, though.
Yeah. So these robots, like so many of the militarized police equipment that we have in this country, originates from the armed forces. They're typically, so these are not like at least the way the police department kind of characterized their ambitions. These are not the kind, like the spot robots that have been equipped with assault rifles. These are bomb disposal robots that would otherwise be, rather than disposing of bombs, they would be equipped with bombs and basically be little suicidal things, I think is the way that the police department has generally characterized the way they would use them.
Right. And because, like, this has happened before. This happened in, it was 2016 in Dallas. Yep. I was living there at the time. Yeah, there was a man, Michael Xavier Johnson, who was killing police officers in Dallas.
He was on like a rooftop, right?
Yeah, it was not. I mean, he was on a rooftop. It was a very weird, intense time in the city, because it took place, you know, over a certain amount of time, and like they knew they were looking for a specific subject or a suspect, and like it was also this time where there were a lot of protests going on in the city and a lot of people walking around with assault rifles. It was a whole, you know, it was a whole
thing. That's a thing you can do in Texas.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, of course. It's Texas. And they get him cornered in a parking garage. And they kind of, he's not, their story is, and I believe them, is that he was not going to go peacefully. So they put explosives onto a bomb disposal robot. They knew if men were used to approach and apprehend him, people were at the very least going to get shot. Some of them were probably going to be killed. And instead of doing that, they sent in a bomb disposal bot with C4, I think, strapped to it and detonated it and killed him. And this was the first domestic use of a killer robot, essentially remote controlled death. So I think it's wild that it took this long for someone else to write the rules down. And I think it's interesting that it's San Francisco. What do you make of that?
Yes. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on here. And, part of it has to do with another recent ordinance that the city passed regarding the police department's ability to view private camera live streams for general crime fighting purposes. And this was an extremely controversial measure in San Francisco for two reasons. One is, in 2019, San Francisco passed an ordinance banning the use of facial recognition by government agencies, including the police department. And this was an extremely kind of progressive move by the city that signaled a real desire to limit the amount of technological spyware / use cases for that kind of surveillance technology for policing purposes. But then COVID hit, and the post-COVID crime wave hysteria had started and really took hold in San Francisco. San Francisco is probably one of the cities most grappling with this, like, law and order versus civil rights question of any city in the country at the moment. and the live streaming of private cameras very much got wrapped into this debate. Basically, the police department argued that it would help them in some cases for solving crimes to be able to view live streams of private cameras. I'm super not clear on how that would work, because the police department has always been able to view like recorded footage, right? That's a thing that like every police department in the country can do with either an owner's permission or a warrant. And that has obvious benefits to fighting crime, right? Or like catching criminals. But like, I am super unclear on how viewing live footage is going to help you with that, because it basically means you have to predict in advance when and where crime is going to happen. And that's just, and if you can do that, it seems like it would be better to simply send some cops there to arrest the person rather than have some police officers view the crime remotely and do nothing about it. You know, it's just like, it's really super unclear.
Well, now you can send a robot. You can do, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So like the argument the police department made was like, there was a big conflict over whether they could use this technology during First Amendment events, like protests and stuff. And that was because the police department did use private security cameras from business improvement districts during the George Floyd protests in 2020. And this was incredibly controversial. They got sued by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the ACLU, for doing that, because they technically weren't allowed to do it according to the lawsuit. I think that lawsuit is still winding its way through the courts. But this ordinance basically guarantees the police department can do it again in the future. And they say they don't want to do it for all First Amendment events. They just want to do it so that they can like manage crowd control and that kind of thing. But it's incredibly broad. They can essentially do it whenever they want. And they can just say like, oh, we were worried about crowds, you know, or something, and get away with it. And so that just passed in September. So this police killer robot thing is like right on the heels of it, right? So everyone's very, you know, still upset about that. The main concerns, as you can imagine, is that like nobody wants the police to have a fairly wide berth to be doing essentially extrajudicial killings with robots. It just feels like, at least to privacy and civil rights advocates, like a Rubicon that they don't want to cross. And that's been largely the pushback against the rule.
I think they already have a monopoly on state violence and already routinely get away with extrajudicial killings.
Yes. Especially since the rule applies the same criterion to robot killings as human police, you know, when human police officers kill people.
Right. So you're kind of codifying an extension of the violent of the new weapon.
Yeah. And I think like, broadly speaking, to like any time a military technology is incorporated in civilian policing, it raises serious concerns and alarms. Like these are the incident in Dallas, I think, is pretty fair to say, is a very, very unique case. It is not often that the police corner an extremely violent person who has a known proven track record of killing police officers in a way that like then makes it impossible for them to either, you know, use conventional force or otherwise detain the subject without humans. Like that's just, it was a very unique situation, as evidenced by the fact that to the best of anyone's knowledge, a robot has not been used to kill any suspect since then. Right. In a domestic policing context. And I think one of the big concerns in San Francisco is that while the police say they would only use it in similarly extreme circumstances, there's nothing in the ordinance to like enforce that. Like if the police decide they want to routinely settle, you know, use of force situations with a killer robot, there's technically nothing in the rules that prevents them from doing that.
Also, why wouldn't you?
Right. Like if you've already established that you want to use a robot when the risk to a human police officer is non-zero, well, then how do you start defining risk to the police officer? You know, in the Dallas case, my understanding is it was extremely obvious that if that guy like came within rifle sight of a police officer, he was going to try and shoot them. Whereas
yeah, he'd already generally, killed, he'd killed five people and wounded 11 more. So
right. Like that's in a short amount of not, time. Generally not the circumstances we find them in. And so what you end up with is, I think we've seen this generally with the way police officers engage with members of the public too. Like this is why we see police officers kill people so often, is because they have a wide berth for interpreting what their own personal risk is in any situation. And so certain officers in certain circumstances consider the use of deadly force warranted based on a very low bar, or what I would argue is a very low bar. And that's how you end up with people getting killed in highly controversial settings where like it doesn't seem like they have a weapon, or they have a knife and the officer is standing very far away, or like, you know, situations like that. And what I think people in San Francisco are concerned about is, what if police officers start, you know, what if they chase a suspect, the suspect corners themselves in a room or something, and the person yells like, I have a knife or I have a gun. Is that enough of a bar to then say, bring in the killer robot? Because then you basically have a situation of an extrajudicial killing, that that person never getting a fair trial, you know, never getting tried for whatever, you know, reason they were being pursued by the police in the first place. You can see how this spirals out of control, not immediately perhaps, but over time becomes a policy that we're very uncomfortable with.
I think that's a good, ambiguous, weird place to, in that conversation. I'm sure we're going to talk about killer robots on this show and policing again. I want to go out with a listener calling me on my bullshit. Do you want to do that?
Ooh, that's good. Yeah.
All right. So the last time we talked, we were talking about community feedback, and we got and I went on a little bit of a rant on some of the communities in Texas that have like kind of built their own cities that are free from regulations. Well, somebody that works mm-hmm. in that space reached out to me.
Nice.
I was listening to the
podcast. Sounds like a great space to work in, by the way.
Yeah. I was listening to the podcast today about community feedback. The allegation was made that developers have a free-for-all in red states, particularly in Texas. It's just false. The TCEQ, Commissioner's Court, in every county and code adopted everywhere make it such that a lack of zoning is not the jubilee it might seem to be. Houston, I can't remember the name of the county now. That's going to vex me. But Houston famously has pretty lax. Harris, I think you're right. Harris County. Now I'm having flashbacks to Alamo discussions. Let's not get into that. Harris County famously lacks zoning laws. Anyway, he says, it's not the jubilee it might seem to be. Getting water and electricity to land outside of cities does usually require significant regulatory compliance. Anyway, enjoy the podcasts and your efforts. So thank you for that. I may have oversold the wilding that goes on outside of Texas cities. But now I'm going to like do a deep dive into this so I can make my case the next time you and I talk, Aaron, and I'll come back.
No, that's fascinating, because like there's a whole string of regulations that developers have to abide by in unincorporated areas. Mm-hmm. But I think like to the point of that podcast, right? Like they have to abide by the regulations, but that doesn't necessarily require community feedback process.
Right.
Which is kind of like what the story was about. But that I think he's generally right. Like we probably overstated, both of us, the degree to which like if you have a piece of land in an unincorporated area, you just like get some hammer, wood and nails and start building.
You do still need electricity and plumbing. I mean, some people go without that, but if you're wanting to build, yeah. But I was talking about like the building of like suburbs essentially.
I was imagining your communities being like totally off the grid. Like the wilding that you were talking about.
There is some of that, especially Texas is is much bigger than you think it is. You know, it's like four really? Hours.
I think it's pretty big.
Yeah. Yeah. 4 hours between major cities. I mean, when I lived there, it was like, you get so used to driving. Everything is about half an hour away. At least, you know, if you've got plans, you have to build in at least half an hour to an hour for travel just for that.
I mean, that's how I am. That's exactly what I think living in Brooklyn, I will just say. Like,
Yeah, but like, you're not in a car. You're on a train.
No, I'm on my bike or a train. Everything is, or walking. It doesn't matter. Everything is 45 minutes away. Literally everything. You want to go somewhere? It's 45 minutes away. Is it, where do you, you know, if it's going to be longer than 45 minutes walking, then you're biking. If it's going to be longer than 45 minutes biking, then you're taking the train. It's just like, it's going to be 45 minutes. Don't worry about it.
So what I've learned is that Texas and Brooklyn living, no difference.
Exactly. I was going to say I'm more likely not to die on my way there, but I mean, I'd have to dive into the data on biking in Brooklyn versus driving in Texas.
I mean, it really depends on what part of Texas that you're driving in. Dallas can be a pretty scary place. It's like the Thunderdome out there. Somehow I liked it. I don't know. Like, there's an aggression there that the drivers here lack in South Carolina. It really throws me off. I know you don't drive. This is like all... But it's like,
I used to.
But they, like, every time I get back into Dallas, something like clicks in my brain. Like, all right, I understand this. Like, it's everyone for themselves. You got to be real defensive and yet aggressive. If you put on your blinker
in Massachusetts.
Yeah. My dad, like, it's funny. My dad spent a lot of time in Massachusetts. He said the same thing.
The people- Massachusetts is pretty wild driving wise. It's like, I feel like most other places I've driven, there's a fair amount of predictability to most drivers, whether it's the culture is like aggression in Dallas or like placidness in South Carolina. In Massachusetts, it's like every single car is doing a random number generator type situation. And if an 8 comes up, it's swerve right. And if a 4 comes up, it's swerve left or whatever. It's like there is just no predictability whatsoever to what anyone is going to be doing at any given time. Some car that's pissing you off because it's going like 50 in the right lane on a 65 highway is like all of a sudden going to start going 85. And there's just like no rhyme or reason. Like, it is wild, man. It's wild stuff.
Aaron Gordon, thank you so much for coming on to Cyber and walking us through the railroad strike and or lack thereof at the moment. And the killer robots in San Francisco. I am gonna look into this community thing because now it's gonna make me be like a dog with a bone. And the next time we're on, we're gonna talk about it.
We need to do a whole cyber episode on driving cultures. I think
that too. Yeah, driving cultures and unincorporated cities and townships in Texas.
I can already see the listener count just ramping up for those.
I don't like some of the Texas stuff is super weird. I should tell you about maybe do this on the show. Like the place that I was born and am from is like a Stephen King novel. As a small preview, there was one of the major churches in town was so scary that the town gathered together and burned it down in the 70s. To try to drive them out, and they rebuilt. And the church that was burned down, they are definitely the villains of the story. I will just say that. So look forward
like
to that.
You got a book to write.
Yeah,
like
I've got a book to write. I've thought about it. So if you like cyber, if you like hearing Aaron and I ramble, did my audio win? Okay, there we go. There we go. The music's back, baby. Please subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitch where you can see live versions of the show. I'm not going live this week because I've got a cold and I've been hacking things up while muted on mic while Aaron's been talking about the railroad. It's been unpleasant, but we will be back next week and we will be live again. Go to youtube.com/motherboard or twitch.tv/motherboardtv and get notified when we go live. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Aaron, thank you again for being on. And we will see you next week. Stay safe out there on the internet. It's getting crazy.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author Elizabeth Gilbert about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.